Welcome to the Andrew D'Angelo podcast.
Constant Constance. Each week, Andrew, renowned jazz saxophonist and brain cancer survivor, invites us to look at the many worlds of his guests with conversations that cover all the arts, human resilience, a little bit of politics, and a lot of humour.
You can't fail to have a fantastic time.
All right, are you ready to illuminate? Hey, let's everyone. Yeah, we are here today with my super, super sweet and beautiful friend, Mr. Adam Cooper, and he is a software engineer and just basically one of the nicest people I think I've ever met in my life. It seems to be a running theme in this show is nice people. Maybe I should just call it my show Nice People. Anyway, welcome, Adam. It's so great. Thank you for taking your time to join us. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on. I'm very excited.
Okay. One of the things that when I posted about this interview, my friend, my British friend, he's a laureate. What's a laureate? What is that?
I don't know. Like if you've won a prize, like a Nobel Prize, is she a Nobel Prize laureate?
No, but she talks like, you know, she's British. She has this beautiful accent. She's an actress. Uh-huh. And I labeled her as a Shakespearean actress. And she was, that could be further from the truth, Andrew. And I was like, right. Okay. Well, anyway, she was just super impressed that you kind of knew nine languages. And then I was wondering, like, I mean, at one point you did speak or know nine languages.
Okay.
Right?
So, you know, this is fun. It's funny that this has been termed in this way, because it has been termed in this way since I'm a very little kid. The fact is that there's never really been a time when I've been able to speak more than two languages, really.
Okay.
But, you know, when I was a kid, language learning was my thing. It was my favorite thing. And I studied French and I studied Spanish. I studied Latin. I studied Hebrew as a little guy. And then when I got a little older, I started adding sprinkles of things, like a little bit of Russian. And then I studied some Greek, ancient Greek. So the thing about Latin and Greek is you don't speak them. So like even as however good I got at reading Latin and Greek, it's not like you say, oh, I speak seven languages. You can't include Latin and Greek because they're all dead, the people who spoke them, right? So, right. But it's funny. I've studied a ton of languages. I'm really passionate about languages. I've studied a lot about linguistics, historical linguistics, and that kind of thing. This is like my parallel existence. Is a full-time linguist. That's right. In the parallel universe, that is definitely what I'm doing.
Okay, fair enough. Well, all right. So you have the programming or software engineer side of you, and then your interest in languages. And by the way, I mean, I speak Norwegian, but I can read it way better than I can speak it.
Yeah.
And same with Danish and Swedish and French. I can read those, but sometimes, you know, conversationally speaking a language is way different than being able to understand the grammatical structure or whatever, right?
I'm way better at reading a language, Spanish, French, Italian, German. I'm way better at reading them than I am at understanding them.
Right. Well, there you go, folks. Adam knows more. Know that he is a very, very humble person, and he knows more than he's willing to say, because he doesn't like adulation. You're not a fan of applause.
Well,
maybe.
I don't know. I'm just trying to be sort of accurate, because I've sort of, this is something that people have wanted to say about me for my whole life, and I've always been sort of uncomfortable with it, because, you know, if I'm in a situation where I have to like actually converse in these languages, it's actually very hard.
Right.
Unless I've sort of spent some time preparing, you know?
Right. And I don't know about you, but when I was learning Norwegian, and let's say we're out having a beer or a coffee or something, and so I'm working on my speaking of the language, and they just correct me the whole fucking time. But I'm like, if you understood what I said enough to correct me, then just answer me in, you know, Norwegian or Danish, whatever, right?
So wait, so this, you had this experience in both Norway and Denmark?
The Norwegians are a little more uptight. The Danes are a little less. They're like, we understood what you meant. But yeah. The Norwegians like, no, I snuck norsk. You know, it's like, no, it's not how you say it, man. You got to say it like this. I'm like, come on. Come on. So in other words, I think that, you know, people who are expressing their desire to understand other people, not just in language, but just in culture, it's about judgment, you know? And that's one thing I love about you is you're not very judgmental of other people. And you've always been super kind to me. And when I bust out in the wrong way or, you know, scream at your wife, Nicole, or, you know, just have a really cry moment, you're very, you're a nurturer. And I appreciate that about you. And I think we all have these struggles, you know, and understanding is very important. Wouldn't you agree, or am I putting words in your mouth?
No, you're not putting words in my mouth. It's an interesting point you make. Yes, communication and understanding are, of course, vitally important. And the language issue is a sort of a fascinating aspect of that, because there are so many different, the dynamics are so different. So for example, when you are in Norway, right? Most people, at least in Oslo and Bergen, I'm going to guess, speak English.
Oh, of course. Everybody in Europe speaks English.
In Denmark, I suspect that the farmhands speak English.
Oh yeah. Everybody. They grow up on, you know, whether it's British English or American English TV, I mean,
right.
And films and so forth.
Right.
And the crazy part is how so many Americans just expect that. Like they don't even attempt to reach over the fence and learn a few words or something like that.
Right.
I went over with this young fella on tour to Italy and we went to get a coffee. And he was like, yeah, give me, can I get like two double espressos? I was like, man, you know, just
yeah,
warm it up a little bit.
Here. Yeah. They say, and this is, you've spent way more time in Europe than I have, but they say that if you make your first foray in a conversation in the language of the country, and even if it's just, I'm sorry, my Italian is crap.
Yeah, even if it's that, like, I'm sorry, sir. Do you speak English or
right.
I don't speak any Italian or German or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Like at least that gratuity, right?
Would right. Be nice. Warms it up immediately.
A little bit,
you know, and I can tell you, I had a similar experience and it was years and years ago. And I was going to Italy and I missed my flight and had to take a flight to a different part of Italy and figure out how to get to Rome.
Wow.
So this is actually sort of a long and kind of crazy story, but I'll focus in on the relevant.
It's all right. It's your time, man. Go.
Okay. So the relevant bit of the story is that I sort of acquired a traveling companion, this British dude who was also confused, I think, about how he was going to get where he was going in Italy. And I had flown from Britain because I was living in Britain at the time. So we go up to, we're in the train station and we go to the a guy in a uniform and the British guy just starts launching in English. He says, we need to get to such and such a place, such and such. Do you speak any English? And the guy did not move and said, nope.
Well, obviously.
And I had enough Italian.
Right.
Where I can say to the guy in Italian, you know, where do we go to get the train to wherever it was we were headed?
Right.
And he looked at me and he said, Binario Cinque, track 5.
Right.
And I said to the English guy, track 5, let's go. Molte grazie. it was so funny. It's exactly as you say.
Yeah. It really, I think if anything about the Donald Trump presidency has taught us is to be gracious. We as Americans, we need to understand that being gracious to other cultures is something that is very important. And I don't know how, whatever people's politics are, is not what I'm talking about. I'm just talking about understanding other people's perspectives just on issues within the US, and then also it's, you know, around the world. Wouldn't you agree that this has taught us a little bit of compassion and also a little bit of fight or flight, maybe? I don't know.
I mean, I think, I mean, we'll see how it plays out, because of course, neither you nor I has had opportunity to travel outside of the country. You know, obviously Trump has just left. You know, I think that, and again, you have more experience with this, you can speak to it better, but I think that Americans traveling abroad have a reputation for sort of bull in China shop approach, not just with regard to language, but with regard to culture, just kind of throwing their weight around and expecting to be catered to and so on. I know that when I was traveling in Europe, I came across more than one American who had put Canadian flags on their luggage so that people would think they were Canadian.
And not American.
And oh, the Canadians all, put Canadian flags on their right. stuff. They didn't want to be mistaken for American.
Right.
So, I mean, I wonder, my expectation will be that the Trump presidency may have made our reputation even worse.
Right.
And, you know, I think that's something that we will have to pay attention to. That, you know, so yes, yeah. You're right. We have to pay attention as Americans traveling abroad. We have to pay attention and be gracious, I think, even more so probably going forward. You know?
Right. And, you know, an interesting conversation that I had on Zoom about Medicare for All is that, you know, people who are fighting Medicare for All, in other words, for some reason, they don't think that we should have that, there's a lot of people that just haven't experienced it. Okay, maybe they've been in Canada, but, you know, I lived in Copenhagen, I lived in Europe, and I know, you know, I needed an MRI, okay? And my doctor, this was right after I had brain cancer and I was living in Copenhagen as artist in residence. And my doctor's like, I realize that you're in Europe, but you need to get an MRI. So I talked to one of my students and I said, do you know where, actually I talked to a bunch of my students. One of them, I said, do you know where I can get an MRI? And he goes, yeah, my brother's a doctor. You just go over there. He'll give you one. Right. So I go to the place, the office, and I was, you know, obviously how much does it cost? And he goes, what are you talking about? I said, well, I'm just making sure that I have the money that, you know. And he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. Just go get changed and we'll do the scan and you can go. Right. There's no desk where you pay. I was kind of being treated like royalty because of artists in residence. But he's like, yeah, I don't really know what you're talking about. He goes, you can give me one of your records. So I gave him one of my records. Right. but I just think so many people don't know that experience.
Oh, you hear these stories. I've seen threads on Twitter about Americans being in Europe for extended period of time and having to have some sort of medical procedure done. And the amount of time that is spent negotiating the difference between the expectation and the reality. So much back and forth, like what you're right. talking about, where I don't know what you mean. Your appointment's at 2:15. It's 2:15.
Get in there. Yeah, get in there and do whatever procedure it is you got to do.
And the American is always desperate to figure out how to pay now before they right. get slammed with a giant bill later. You know,
that was totally me. I'm guilty as charged. I was told, like, you know, I had my bank card, or like, should I transfer the money, you know, via wire, which is a big thing in Europe.
Yeah.
And they're like, we have no idea what you're talking about. but so when people, you know, and people, when Americans fight healthcare for all, it's just because maybe they haven't been in Europe. Been to Canada. You know?
I think that, you know, you've spent a lot of time in Europe.
Yeah.
I've spent some time in Europe. Nicole, my wife, has spent some time in Europe, and we know, but the vast majority of Americans have never left the United States. I think that's a fair statement to say.
Oh yeah, it's unusually generalizing from you because you're just not one of those people. You like facts. You and your wife, Nicole, like things to be factual. So, but I think that, by the way, I'm sure people will correct us in the comments if, you know,
that's cool.
They want,
right? I'm in. Yeah.
But I 100% believe that. And I remember after my, gosh, how long did I live in Copenhagen? Let's just pick a number, 6 months. I lived there 6 months, let's say. I remember coming back into the US and I landed at Newark and I was like, holy shit, Americans are assholes, man. I mean, guys were yelling at each other and like pissed off because their bag hadn't come out of the bag claim. I'm like, dude, just wait until your bag comes out. Oh, this is fucking bullshit, man. Where's my fucking, whatever these guys were, New York, guys. But I'm just, damn, I want to go back.
Yeah.
I want to go back to Europe where everybody, okay, my generalization time, where everybody's cool, man. And, they're all right with being patient and,
I mean, I think that you're hitting upon something that is real. And again, I'm having to speculate about this, but I think that there is some correlation between the quality of life and the security of sort of basic needs that Europe has,
mm-hmm.
and the ability to be chill. I think it's way easier to be chill if you don't have to worry about being piled under debts for healthcare and piled under debts for, the education you sought,
right.
And, being able to get unemployment benefits if you lose your job and so on and so forth. And these things that the Europeans have give them the headspace to be more chill, yep. to not sweat it if the bag doesn't come out of the baggage carousel right away, because they don't have these sort of 10,000 other things to sweat on their minds.
I have a friend, USA, lives in North Carolina, who broke his arm, or actually shattered a bone in his arm in a just freak accident, whatever you want to call it, maybe a week ago now.
Oof.
And he had health insurance, right? Like, what do they call that? Public health insurance. I mean, he pays,
mm-hmm.
but his deductible was $8,000. So they haven't done the surgery. And you can't really set this kind of a shatter. So
okay.
they're going to have to put in a bar or whatever you call it, a stent or whatever they call that.
A rod.
And that part, who knows what that's going to cost. And that'll be covered by the insurance. But, he broke his arm. It's $8,000 gone,
right.
for him.
Yep.
And when you're in Europe, I'm not saying people aren't reckless, but you always know, as in my case, if you're diagnosed with brain cancer, they're going to take care of you.
Right.
Or if you break your arm or whatever happens, you're
right.
going to be cool. And
yeah.
you're right. Not walking around thinking about, oh man, what if this happens? What if that happens? What if somebody breaks into my house? Should I get, home insurance? Should I get medical insurance? And, and then all of this stuff, adds up, and it's just like,
yeah.
How can you be relaxed?
It's, I mean, I think, everybody here knows it's oppressive, even when you have insurance, navigating the healthcare system here is oppressive. It's astonishing when you sort of drill down into the details, of getting billed for something that you shouldn't be billed for, and then having to decide whether or not you have the energy to fight both the provider and the insurance company for it, because that's what you have to do. You have to call them and you have to explain to them that this bill is not something that I need to pay because this is covered by my insurance. And so I'm not going to pay it. So you need to undo it. and so on and so forth. And then sometimes you make the determination, I have the money right now and don't have the energy to fight it. But it's always something. It's always something. Even when you have insurance, even when you have money to pay, there are still ways for the industry to make it stressful for you.
Can I share the story about my neighbor? And also, we're calling her Mrs. M on this podcast, Adam Cooper. Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
For her own safety. I think I spoke to you and your wife, Nicole, about this when it happened, where I went down and my neighbor pressed the life alert button, and I'm her first dial. So they call me at maybe 6:30 AM, something like this. So I get dressed and I run down, and she's on the edge of her bed at 96 years. Well, she was 95 at that time, you know, vomiting or dry heaves. And I go, do you need a bucket or something? She goes, yeah, Andrew. So I go and get a pan off the stove and try to hand it to her so she can. She goes, no, not that one.
That's my good pan.
Yeah, exactly. That's Andrew. You know, she like the whole. And so then I get the wastebasket, right? And she's okay with this. So anyway, the ambulance comes very quickly, and I decide to ride with her. And so we're in the back of this ambulance. They gave her a new bucket in the ambulance. She's vomiting in the ambulance. And the guy goes, you know, what's your insurance? She asks a fucking 90 fucking 5-year-old fucking person who's vomiting in a bucket with their tenant or whatever, with their friend, son, second son in the back, where, what's your insurance? And so anyway, she goes, Andrew, and she's vomiting. It's in my pocketbook. I'm not digging through your purse. She called it a pocketbook. So I hand it to her. So she's vomiting and she gets her insurance card. Okay, this is gross. America, this is gross. All right, fast forward. I'm taking her mail, helping her deal with her bills while she's in the hospital for a month. Okay. And they're working on her. Thankfully, maybe it was life-threatening, but she didn't pass away. And I opened one of the bills, and it's a bill from the hospital for $15,800, something like this. And I said, Mrs. Mayer, what do you want? She goes, what's that bill? I said, I don't know. It's from the hospital. She's still in the hospital getting a bill for being in the hospital for $15,000. Again, I don't remember the exact number. It was over 15 grand. And she goes, I'm not paying that bill. Yeah, you shouldn't have to. Why, America? Why are we treating our citizens like this? Why are you not on the streets? Why are you not saying that we should all have health care, at least if you're 65 plus?
And they do. That's the crazy thing about that story is that she's 96. She has Medicare. So why are you sending her a bill? For Christ's sake, she's it's a 96. The least you could do is she doesn't have to get any more bills in the mail. You know,
she should get a Hallmark card that says, congratulations, we hope you're healing up, get well sooner, right? And not a fucking bill.
It's ridiculous.
The idea that people can be against something that seems so humanly, you know, sound and loving and kind blows my fucking mind.
It's fascinating how many angles there are to this issue, right? So, you know, we've talked a little bit about the European angle and how they do it and some of the benefits that they derive from having done it. You also have in this country historically conservatives back, and then, you know, today this is considered, Medicare for All is considered a liberal left-wing issue, right? It's mostly people on the left who are supporters of this. Back in the 60s and the 70s, conservatives, some of them, including Milton Friedman, argued that it would be beneficial for business if the government covered healthcare rather than employers covering healthcare costs, some percentage of them at all, for their employees, which is, of course, how we have it set up now. So at that time, you could have a reasonable conservative argument for government paid single payer healthcare. That has vanished. That's gone. Nobody on the conservative side that I know of talks about that anymore, but they did.
Right. Actually, I think I saw a video that's now on YouTube of, I'm not as good as you with the politicians, but it was a Republican talking about how they started Social Security and what it meant and who it was going to help. And they were highlighting a jazz musician from New Orleans. This, it wasn't Louis Armstrong, it was some trumpet player from New Orleans. And he will now have health care and he will get paid every month. And but it was a conservative, a Republican, who was announcing this on, you know, kind of one of those longer commercials back in the what decade? 50s? 40s?
Social Security was in the 30s or the 40s.
Yeah, I think 1934 is what is coming to my mind, but please, everybody. Yeah. And I was like, oh, wow. Like, yeah, that was kind of a Republican thing back then.
Yeah, I guess that there were some Republicans on board back then. Yeah.
Adam, since you're in the software engineer world, coding world, I had a question about censorship, and obviously it, as close to this interview is when Donald Trump was banned from Twitter and all other social media. Parler's been taken down. Who knows where that will all be once, you know, I publish this episode. But I wanted to maybe parlay it. I put an ad up on Instagram and Facebook for my band Human Feel in 2019. And I got this message that your ad goes against our terms and conditions. I don't remember the exact phraseology. And so I was going back and forth with a bot. I was saying, what? It's just an ad for my band's record. And the bot was just saying, yeah, well, it goes against our, you know, because it's sexually oriented or something. And I finally got a real person, and I think her name was Sherry or Shelly. I'm not sure, but I finally got a real person in the chat. And I said, look, it's just the name of my band, which, by the way, has been around since 1989. So she says, oh, sorry about that. And literally click my ad published. And as I believe I told you before, you know, I think there was about 180,000 engagements on that ad. And so the ad did very well. The record's done very well, but it's, what is this? Are we, I don't know, you probably can just take over, but are we self-policing? Is it okay to ban Donald Trump? Or is that like, I mean, or we were talking about Glenn Greenwald from The Intercept,
yeah,
and his situation. I mean, from whatever angle you want, because you're on the other side of the wall, basically, right? You're the one, you know.
Kind of. I mean, This is some rough stuff, right?
Right.
So there's some video of Noam Chomsky, smart guy.
Yeah.
Weird trivia: Noam Chomsky and I went to the same elementary school.
There you go, folks. There you go.
50 years apart, but
whatever.
And he says, here's the thing, I'm paraphrasing, here's the thing about free speech. Free speech, advocating for free speech, defending free speech only matters when you are defending speech that you don't like. He says, anybody can defend free speech for speech that they do like. Goebbels would defend free speech for speech that you do like. So would Stalin.
Right.
But it's speech that you don't like that tests your principle surrounding free speech. Mm. So when we talk about Donald Trump's being censored, and we talk about people who, Parler being taken down. People who are Democrats may find this to be heartening, right? But if they do find it heartening, they find it heartening presumably because they don't like the speech that Donald Trump engages in, and they don't like the speech that is engaged in on Parler.
Right.
The problem with this is that historically, censorship is wielded against the left. It's wielded against the kind of speech that is likely to upset the powerful interests in society. So, you know, it's coming. And it already has started happening. There has already been significant censorship of some left speech on social media. So, for example, a lot of Palestinian activists have found their accounts suspended and removed from Twitter.
Right.
So, you know, it's frustrating. And you brought up Glenn Greenwald. And I guess full disclosure, I used to work at First Look Media, which is the media company that Glenn Greenwald started that includes The Intercept.
Okay.
And anyway, so Glenn's experience has been personal. Glenn started The Intercept and First Look Media primarily as a place to sort of be a home for the materials that Edward Snowden liberated from the NSA, but also because he wanted a place where he could write and be a journalist without having to answer to anybody.
That's one way to do it, is just start your own paper or like news outlet, which right. Trump is threatening to do. We'll see by the time this is published, you know.
Yeah, I always suspected that was his angle. But so Glenn,
anyway, interrupted. Yeah, sorry.
No problem. So he starts the paper and the media company, and then fast forward a few years to this past fall, and Glenn filed an article, and it got, you know, the editorial staff didn't want to run it as it was. And Glenn was sort of, I think, probably surprised on some level that, hey, I understand that you're the editor in chief and so on and so forth, but this is, I started this organization so that I could write whatever I want. And our arrangement has been, and indeed in our contract is that I get to write whatever I want.
Right.
They push back. And so rather than sort of have a fight about it inside The Intercept, he left. And now he writes, basically freelance on Substack. So we are having a censorship issue, and it was election related stuff. It was about, it was an article about the laptop that was purportedly Hunter Biden's laptop, and it had some damaging information about Hunter Biden and some potential stuff surrounding Joe Biden that would probably warrant some investigation. And this was right before the election. And Glenn felt like The Intercept didn't want to be seen as harming the chances of Joe Biden before the election. And he didn't think that was legit. So yeah, we're now sort of in the middle of a kind of censorship crisis, it would seem. I don't think that, from what I have seen, I don't think it's being treated as a crisis. I feel like we're sort of heading into very dangerous waters where censorship is being mainstreamed, where nobody is sort of having sort of second thoughts or doubts about what has happened with regard to Trump and Parler and stuff like this and Glenn. And if left unchecked, I think it could land us in some seriously bad situations.
It's very interesting. I agree with you. For the most part, but I also engage with Glenn on Twitter, and I actually think this was a really good move for him. he is the way he's speaking. And I saw an interview. He posted a clip in an interview, and just how freely and how open he is able to be at this point is kind of cool. And, but of course, like you said, it's because I agree with him. If I disagreed with him, I might want to censor him. That's sort of what I'm getting from you, is what you, I'm extracting from that statement. You just, those statements.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, look, I think it's completely natural impulse to want speech that you don't like to have a lower profile in the marketplace of ideas. You know, I mean, if somebody is saying horrible things, or, you know, there's speech you don't agree with, and then there's stuff that is just wretched and horrible and damaging. And you would rather, you know, the impulse to want to live in a world where you don't have to hear that is a natural impulse, I think. That being said, I think that we have a responsibility. So, I mean, I think that we have a responsibility to fight against that impulse, because not all of the impulses that we have are ones that optimize the society in which we live. And I think that that's an impulse that we need to examine and probably curb. Because again, as Chomsky said, you know, free speech as a principle is tested against speech that you don't like. And so we need to orient ourselves, I think, in that way. I think that censorship is bad for society, ultimately.
All right, so let's say you're on Parler and you're posting, let's kill all those Negroes or something like that. Or let's kill, like in my case, you know, let's kill all those faggots.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So like, I mean, shit, I don't want people talking like that. And I mean, then is it okay to censor them and block them? I mean, I don't know. And I am certainly not an expert. And I defer to you and your wife, Nicole.
Well, no, I mean, this is the stuff, right? Like as soon as you say that, right, I have a physical reaction of disgust.
Yeah, I literally, when I say the word faggot, I have a physical reaction. Like,
yeah.
I feel like I'm hating my family, and it feels terrible. It's gross.
Yes.
And so it's like, well, all right, well, maybe those people should be censored, but everybody else is cool. You know, Glenn Greenwald is cool, but, you know, that guy from, you know, Nebraska who's talking about faggots is not cool. Or, you know, somebody from Oklahoma who wants to, you know, carry a gun. You know, I don't know. Help me out here. Fill me in.
I think this is the stuff. This is the area where we have to hang in, where we have to hang on, and we have to be thinking humans, right? So in a calm moment, you know, you're watching that Chomsky video. I mean, actually, Chomsky is talking about a Holocaust denier. Someone is giving him a hard time about defending the right of a Holocaust denier to speak. And this is the context in which Chomsky is making his point. So we gotta, it's the speech that we don't like. And that's where we got to hang on and understand our position.
Adam, can I interrupt? Can I interrupt?
Yeah.
The speech that we don't like is one thing, okay? That I understand.
Yeah.
But when somebody is literally posting or writing on Substack or whatever they're doing about literal, like, racism or homophobia or sexism or... And I'm not really into cancel culture, but it's not speech. I don't like that speech. But first of all, why would somebody want to kill faggots and Negroes? There's more to it than just the speech. There's a human that has this hatred,
right?
And that could turn violent, as we saw,
sure,
over the last 4 years. And so I'm torn. For me, Greenwald, Snowden, Assange, these people are just they're exposing. That's different. Exposing is different than actually making a statement that we want to kill all of these people, or we want to, you know, cancel all of these people, or we want to, you know, torture all of these immigrant children and families. To me, that's more than speech. That's a, what is it? A dynamic, an energy, a way of living, a philosophy. It's dangerous to me.
Okay. So let's talk about it. So I think that at least in the United States, you're sort of subject to some legal liability if you make threats to harm. Now, I don't know if you say something broad, like, I am going to murder all Negroes, you know, I think that might be sort of too broad to put you in legal hot water. Mm-hmm. But as we saw recently, somebody threatened to assassinate specifically AOC.
Right.
And they're in hot water.
Good.
Yes. So there's the threat of physical violence, which is, you know, sort of a legal area. But as far as, you know, expressing.
Funny, there's a cop driving by your house.
Yes. not unusual.
Sorry.
That's okay. here they come.
Sorry, man. I just That's could cool. not no, notice work. That. Well played, officer. Well fucking played, man. We're watching you, Adam Cooper.
Oh my God.
Sorry.
Okay. No, that's cool. All right. So, So it's the speech that is hate speech, right? Mm-hmm. I think that what people are concerned about is that it can lead to violence, even though it is not in itself a threat.
It's not violent in and of itself is what I was going to say.
Right.
I was going to fill in your sentence there. Yeah.
Yeah. But it can lead to violence. Right. It leads to an environment in which violence is more likely. It constitutes a kind of psychological violence where, you know, because minorities, right, immigrants, African-Americans, gay people, because minorities are in the minority, it is likely that in a free speech situation, there's going to be less speech by minority groups and more speech by majority groups. And therefore, minority groups are likely to experience more hate speech in a free speech situation. All of these things are true. It's unfortunate. It's terrible.
It's very sad for me.
But yes. And nonetheless, I think what free speech advocates argue is that the alternative of living in restricted speech situation is that eventually, ultimately, minorities will find themselves with their speech restricted because minorities, again, are more likely to represent threats to the greater power structure in society.
It's interesting because I was following the Portland protests, you know, pretty much every day, I would at least tune in. And there's this guy who I'm attempting to get on the show. He's also a musician, and he does also video game podcasts, Saul Luna. And he was live streaming from Portland, right? And it was really kind of getting famous just live streaming the protests. And people were like, hey, Saul, what's up? You know, and he's like, yeah, man, cool. And then as soon as he started to speak out, you know, against the cops or whatever he was doing, okay, I'm not going to put words in his mouth, but I think people understand at this point, like as a Black American living in Oregon, you know, he was like anti these tear gassing and everything they were doing. He helped start the, they have to announce that they're going to fuck with you before they fuck with you, the cops.
Oh, nice.
He was one of the people that helped, you know, proliferate that, you know, legally you have to tell us you're going to start shooting us before you shoot us, you know, and then there was that canned, this is considered a riot, an unruly, whatever that is. Right.
Right. Yeah.
And guess what? They started threatening his life and his family. And like, we're coming to get you, motherfucker, and stuff like this. Right. It's like, what? Like, what? Like, the guy's just covering a protest. And right. He also was very silent. Sometimes for an hour, he would not even say a word. He's just like filming. Oh, you know, see one of those canisters go off or somebody get arrested, you know. And then as soon as he would speak up about his videos, either in a Twitter post or whatever, guess what? People wanted to come after him.
Right.
It's so out. And I mean, as a gay man, I guess I'm a minority, but I don't know what that would feel like. I mean, it really hurt his feelings, obviously, right? Like,
it's terrifying.
His right? children? I mean, like, what? Like, what? We're going to come after you and your kids. He's like,
Well, this is analogous, I think, to the Assange situation, right?
How so?
Well, what was Assange trying to do that got him into so much trouble? He was exposing violence perpetrated by the U.S. Army.
Right.
And, you know, frankly, straight up war crime, because they shot and killed civilians. They shot and killed journalists in Iraq. And that video was exfiltrated by Chelsea Manning and published by Julian Assange.
Right, but the difference is private citizens did go after Assange. The government did. And in the case of Saul Luna and the protests, these are private citizens threatening his life and his family.
Are they? Or are they? I mean,
I don't know. Good question, Adam Cooper. All right, that's why I love you. I don't know, sir. I don't know.
I mean, it's fascinating if it's just private citizens. Who the heck are they? I mean, but I guess that there are people, you know, on the private citizens who are sort of on the other side of that conflict, who are not the police, but who are supporters of the police. And I'm thinking of the Oath Keepers and the Three Percenters and the Proud Boys. And
so you think it's possible? Let's just keep using Saul as Saul Luna as an example. And that's not his real name. Okay, so we're cool there. You're thinking it's possible these people threatening him are actually on the inside, that they might be insurrectionists or people who are cops or firefighters or something like this, or politicians.
I mean, we don't know. That's
or like, hey man, I'll give you $500 if you threaten this motherfucker that's covering the protests, you know, Black Lives Matter, and make him sound like an Antifa left-wing nut job. Like, post right. about it. We'll pay you.
Yeah.
Is that kind of what you're inferring here? Or,
I mean, I think it could be any permutation of those things.
Right. Okay. So I got real specific because I know with you and Nicole, your wife, that it's better for me to be specific about what I'm thinking.
I feel like you're thinking along the lines of what I'm thinking. I mean, it's a situation where it's impossible to say, but I mean, I guess, look, yes, but I think it's still a helpful analogy because they're still getting, you know, why are they getting attacked? They're getting attacked because they're exposing truths.
Right.
Right. That are difficult for some people.
Do you think that, I mean, can we use predictive text here for a second? Do you think there's a way out of this without going into this? Meaning, you said we're in dangerous territory with censorship, and it's very interesting. And you obviously had a lot of insight because you understand the internet world on a mathematical way. where most of us just use the internet, you developed the internet, right? Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, yes. That's I hear what you're saying. Yeah.
Okay, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm just wondering, do you see a way out of this? Or because so far, everything we talked about is circumstantial, right? My light is on. I'm using a microphone. I'm talking to Adam Cooper. Adam has a hat on. I have headphones on. Somebody just texted me, right? Those are all circumstance. That's what's going on. Would you feel comfortable foreshadowing, or is there a way out of this? Or do we need to just get, I would say, sick and turn over all the rocks and see all the rot and all the crap that we have, and then we heal? That's my opinion. But maybe there's a way out that I can't see because I don't have the knowledge that you have with your.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things, I guess, here. There's the censorship. There's journalistic censorship. There's social media censorship. And there's government censorship, which we really haven't sort of talked about so much. And let's leave that by the side for now, I think.
Yeah, I never brought it up. Don't bring it up.
Okay, I will say this about government censorship. We're not subject to a lot of government censorship, especially in contrast to places like Iran or North Korea or, the old Soviet Union. Right. And yet we find ourselves talking a lot about censorship and feeling like we can't speak freely, even though it isn't the government that is wielding the censorship. So what we have maybe in the United States that is kind of strange is we have self-censorship and we have significant levels of private sector censorship. It's a little strange.
Right. But in the same breath, you mentioned that it's possible with the gentleman I was talking about who was doing the live stream in Portland, the protest, that it could be government operatives
Yes.
So there is maybe some government, and the insurrection, the siege of the Capitol on January 6th, we're learning more and more. And probably by the time this comes out, we'll learn more and more that, these are people from the inside. So politics maybe don't, censorship brought, with a
above board,
above board, right? There, I was gonna say a bright light, but it's not, they're not going, hey man, it's kind of like,
right,
you need to silence that person, you need to take care of that person, we need a little distraction, so a whirlwind, so go do this, and I don't know, I have no idea, and I hear so many different stories, I don't know what to believe, to be honest, Adam.
No, I mean, I think you're right. I guess I was just drawing a contrast between the sort of,
and I'm just making sure that I'm clear.
Yeah.
What you're saying. That's all.
Totally. Okay. So with all of that, with the journalistic censorship, we're in a very tricky situation. I don't know how that boat gets turned around, because it seems that the mainstream journalism is totally fine with the censorship that we've seen, right? You don't hear mainstream journalists, CNN, Fox, MSNBC, advocate for free speech, for like radical free speech. And it is interesting, of course, that journalists are having this stance, because if you go back into the not too distant past, you have the situation with like the Pentagon Papers, where the Times and the Post published these documents that had been exfiltrated out of the Department of Defense by Daniel Ellsberg, and talking about the real situation of the war, the Vietnam War, and getting a lot of threats from the government and publishing anyway.
Adam, you were talking about the Pentagon Papers, but I also, and you can continue with that if you want, but I also wrote down some notes from our conversation the other day, and you said, I don't feel 100% free to say what I want to say. So is that, are you nullifying everything that you've just said, or what do you mean by that statement?
Right. Yeah. So I think that, you know, as we were talking about, we sort of live in this kind of censorship zone, increasingly censorious, I think. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the censorship, most of it maybe is private sector censorship, right? It's, a private company that sort of shuts down certain views, certain.
I know people who've gotten fired for making a post on Twitter or whatever,
right?
Facebook, for just, they're like, you know, just talking some shit or whatever they're doing.
Yep.
And their company sees it and they're like, yeah, you can't work here. It's weird.
Yeah. I mean, this is, it's weird. It is weird. Cause it's like, again, it sort of harkens back to what we were talking about earlier with hate speech. It's like, you know, somebody writes something awful on the internet and then somebody sees it and then goes and talks to their manager, as it were, you know, and notifies their employer, your employee is saying these things on social media. Do you want them representing you? And like outs them in public and stuff, and people get fired and that kind of thing. I live in the world. I live in this country, and I have a job with a company, and I am aware of that when I make public statements such as this. So yeah, but I mean, does that make me a hypocrite for being an advocate of free speech? No, because, you know, I want to live in a society where people can use their free speech rights, where people have free speech rights. How people decide to use them and when and under what circumstances is up to them. So, but I'm aware that freedom of expression seems to be shrinking in the United States. So yeah.
I have a one fan question that I would like to finish off with you, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
And are you aware of Pitchfork?
There is Pitchfork, the music website.
Correct.
Okay. Yes.
So this person wanted to ask you, and they did it. They called me because they didn't know how to write it down. So I'll do my best to ask you the question in a way that this person was unable to formulate the question themselves and post it.
Okay.
Which I don't know. I like talking. So it was neat. It's neat that they called me and they don't want to be named for whatever reason.
Okay.
So this person is saying that Pitchfork is showing intervals in the background so they can get more outreach. He said, is there a connection with further outreach? Are these intervals live? Do you know what he means by intervals? I know what an interval is, but I don't know what he means by intervals.
I don't know what he means. He's talking about the Pitchfork website.
Correct.
Is showing something in the background.
Yeah, like maybe analytics of how many people have looked at that page or listened to that song or read that post.
Yeah.
He was unsure. Like, is this a real-time data that's going on? Or are these intervals just a GIF in the background or something like that?
I'm not exactly sure what they mean. Pretty much all websites are collecting analytics, meaning they're collecting at least some data on who visits what page, how long they spend on that page.
Right.
Pretty much every website does this because they feel like they have to in order to know who their audience is and then sort of understand how they need to make money.
Right. I love when people pick on Facebook. I'm like, folks, everywhere you go on the internet, they're watching you and they're doing it. And they being whatever, whoever you want to like put into that, you know, category.
Right.
They are there. And let's parlay that. This is something I wanted to talk about that is just coming to me is I told you that, I don't know, a month ago or something, I bought some vitamins, vitamin D and this one called Alethro, mm-hmm. which is Siberian ginseng.
Okay.
And as somebody who had 2 brain surgeries and has epilepsy, these I believe are good for me. Nobody mm-hmm. has to agree with me. I believe they're good for me. And then all of a sudden I start seeing fucking ads for the very thing I just bought. They're not advertising other supplements. They're advertising the very thing I just bought. Vitamin D from Life Extension and the Alethro I got from Vitacost. And like, what is that? Like, what?
You know, I as you're saying this, I'm like, wait. And yeah, it's totally weird, right? Because yeah. like, that's not as lay people, we wouldn't sort of think that that's how advertising would work. But let me ask you this. Do the ads come from the retailer that you already bought the stuff from? In other words, not only are they advertising the same product to you, but are they also advertising that product from the exact retailer you bought it from?
How would I know? I don't know how I'd figure that out. I don't know.
Like, did you, like, if you bought the Alethro from Vitacost, is the ad a Vitacost ad?
Well, on the surface, yes. It has their logo.
Okay.
And it says Vitacost, or I'm doing my best to get... I can't remember her name from Life Extension because I really love that company and I want to have her on.
Oh,
but
yeah.
She does a bunch of lives on social media. But yeah, I mean, my point is on the surface, yes, it does look like it's coming. You know, the algorithm is sending it from LEF Life Extension or Vitacost.com.
Yeah.
But how would I know on the back end? I mean, that's your gig. That's not my gig. I don't know.
Oh, well, no. I mean, if it says it's Vitacost and you click on it and then it takes you to Vitacost, it's reasonable to guess that they're the ones who are paying for the ad.
Click on it. I'm like, what the fuck are they advertising the thing I just bought? Like, I can't even get past that. Like, I love Life Extension. I'm happy they're advertising. I'm glad that they want people to buy their products. But I already bought it, man. And I've been buying from them for over 10 years and I'm going to continue to. So it's just weird.
It is strange. I, you know, I'll tell you that I have read that people have sort of gone about their internet lives, surfing to wherever, Googling certain things, and the algorithms can figure out that you're pregnant. For example,
are you serious? Because if you're looking for like a baby carriage or a crib or like
it doesn't
bottles,
even have to, I don't even think it has to be that specific. I think like, you know, certain questions phrased in certain ways, and the timing of them. And I don't know exactly how they do it. I'll have to dig up the story. So I'm not like snowing
myself. So basically, 99% of the world has erectile dysfunction, then, is what you're saying.
It's a sad situation, man, and it's something in the water.
Okay, I concur with you, but also I'm just like, sometimes you see ads over and over and you're like,
My God, the over and over ads. I'm a really energetic ad blocker, personally.
Right. I'm actually, personally, I love that people advertise, and I think that my artist friends and my artist friends should advertise more. And that, I mean, actually, I'll be honest, part of the reason I started this show is like, I want people to know who I am and I want them to know more about me and what I'm doing and why I make the music I make. Cause they get to like sit with me for an hour and, you know, with one of my friends or
you know,
whatever.
Yeah.
So I'm not anti-advertising. And by the way, we wouldn't know what Kleenex is, Band-Aid, Tide, Google, a myriad of other Honda without advertising. We wouldn't even know who these people were.
Yeah. I mean, advertising is kind of funny, right? Because it is a part of commerce, a part of capitalism that people generally, I think, dislike or find distasteful. And I think that the reason that people find it distasteful is that it feels manipulative, right?
Yeah.
Advertising gives people the sense that they're not making their own choices as far as buying things, and that they're being manipulated into buying one product over a competing product, and so on and so forth. So I think that's sort of maybe gets at the root of why it has a kind of a bad rap. All that being said, and we talked about this before, I think that, you know, there's nothing wrong at all with musicians advertising, because that's, it does not sort of, like, no one's being manipulated. Okay, this is broad. No one's being manipulated into buying this record, right?
Right.
Now, in the sort of pop world, where the considerations for making records are, you know, are sales first, right?
Right.
If you're trying to make a hit record, if you're a Swedish producer duo and you're trying to make a hit record, you know, you are making the record in such a way so that it sells the maximum number of copies. But in the,
right,
shall I say, more artistic music world, you know, you're not, you don't really sort of feel, and you correct me if I'm wrong, you don't really sort of feel like you're competing with a jazz record that's coming out a month later or came out a month before.
I think there's competition there for me and other people. I think, you know, trying to get on the top 10 best jazz records of 2021 list, or, you know, whatever it is, 2010, or top 10 jazz records of the last decade. You know, do people have competition there? I think so. Am I, you know, being bold by saying that? Yeah, but
I mean, I think that's probably true. But I think, you know, on some level, when you make a record, or when you record a track,
mm-hmm.
I'm guessing that you are, that the main concern is not, I wonder how many units this is going to shift. I hope this thing shifts a lot of units. You're kind of inclined to make the record that you want to make, or make the track that you want to make, and the sales part of it is maybe secondary to the musical part of it.
In my case, yes. So I'm not sculpting a record or a song, like you said, a single, whatever it is, to give people that I know will sell 8 million copies. True. But at the same time, it's like saying, when you're cooking that meal and you're having people over, you want to make food that they enjoy.
Right.
And so, you know, somebody might say I'm gluten-free, or somebody might say I'm vegetarian. And so you accommodate them. And so my conundrum, and I'll just leave it at me because I don't want to speak for anybody else. My conundrum is, well, yeah, maybe I do want to make, you know, a dinner that 8 million people enjoy. Maybe I do. I just want to make spaghetti, which I do a lot for my friends, because everybody loves spaghetti, right?
Sure.
Or, you know, the other thing is my tacos. So it's just like, yeah, I don't know. And then sometimes I don't really care.
Yeah.
I just like do whatever I want, which is what, right, I'm doing with this show. And the amount of critical input I've gotten for this fucking show, I'm like, really? I'm just doing what I want to do.
Yeah, right.
I want to talk to Adam Cooper. I want to talk to Taus. Taus is a really sweet boy from Denmark, and I just think he's really nice. And that's it.
Yeah.
And I want to talk to J.D. Allen and hear him go into how his, you know, sons were, you know, called, you know, the N-word, and how, you know, racism has, you know, infiltrated their lives, and how he had to have the talk with them. But it wasn't the birds and bees talk. It was like, this is what it's like for you to grow up as a black male in America. So we got to sit down and talk about this. Yeah. And for me, my music is I'm like, I don't care if you don't like the food. If you're gluten-free or vegetarian and you can't eat it, well, all right, whatever. I don't care. But then there's a part of me, yeah, maybe I want to make it a little more palatable. I don't know.
Yeah, okay. No, I don't know, Adam. Because that's like, you can, it varies from song to song or from record to record or whatever, or year to year.
Right.
Like, I hadn't really thought about that.
I mean, if I did sell, you know, what was it? Taylor Swift or somebody just got 50 million like streams on Spotify. Somebody.
Okay. In that room.
And I'm like, if that happened to me, I would be pretty fucking happy.
Right.
I would be, that's cool.
Right.
A lot of people like my food.
Yeah.
Right on.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. And maybe you're shining the light on me and showing me my cobwebs. And I'm like, yeah, maybe I don't put enough thought into likability and enjoyment. And the reality is I want people to enjoy these conversations I'm having and also maybe feel challenged, but not, I don't want people to turn off the TV.
No, know? Well, right. Of course. I mean, yeah. Yeah. You know, another aspect of this, you tell me what you think, is that, you know, artists may be inclined to not just be concerned about making things that people like, but also teaching people about what they like that they didn't necessarily know they liked.
Correct.
So, I mean, that's a factor as well. Like you can be concerned with creating for an audience. And that can also just not just be what are these people into, but like these people will be into this if they know about it.
Do you know what transcribing is when a musician transcribes a solo?
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause your wife, Nicole, is a violinist and plays viola as well. And yes. A colleague of mine. I was talking to somebody the other day and they were like, man, I hear a lot of Ornette Coleman and Albert Eiler in your playing. You know, and I was like, yeah. And I don't know if you know who Albert Eiler is. He's this amazing tenor saxophone player. Right. And I would transcribe him. I couldn't notate what he would play. So I would just play to his records and do my best to sound like he was sounding when he was improvising.
Yeah.
And, you know, that kind of, I'm using you as a pawn at the moment, Adam, because I really want to get this point across that, you know, when I transcribe Albert Eiler, it's sonic. I'm just transcribing his energy and his presence. And it's not, again, you can't write it down. Right. There's no way to write this kind of thing down for me. Maybe somebody else has come up with it. And I find that, you know, maybe if somebody understood when I was quote unquote screaming or squawking, as I've been called, or sounding agitated, I'm like, I'm just kind of channeling my inner Albert Eiler. And this man grew up in a very tumultuous time, you know, politically and racially and even the gay rights movement time. Right. I mean, I don't think Albert was gay or anything, but you know, there was a lot going on. And so that's what I'm playing.
Yeah.
That's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
That's my pasta. I'm just like, nah, man, I'm just playing some Albert Eiler, man. And I don't have any, you know, YouTube videos where I've written down all the charts and, you know, I'm playing along like this. I'm like, I'm just encapsulating this energy.
Yeah, totally.
Very, very important to me. And so thank you for letting me say that to you, even though you might not even care.
since you brought it up, Nicole has mentioned that part of her education, her self-education in jazz was about transcribing solos.
Right.
And I, as a non-musician, I did not know that that was a thing that people did. And I was kind of fascinated by it because, and maybe a lot of non-musicians are like this. Maybe we kind of think that there's something magical about a jazz solo, right? But if you are a musician, somebody with musical training, and you can listen to a jazz solo and then break it down, write it down, or play it and do it over and over again and note for note and sound pretty good at it. And then sort of bring it so deeply into your understanding that when you then go about playing your own stuff, somebody can notice, hey, you sound a little like Ornette and a little bit like Albert Eiler. And, you know, you may be thinking to yourself, well, I spent a little bit of time with that material.
You know? Right. Well, it's interesting. And I appreciate this back and forth, Adam. I really appreciate it because, you know, when I was a kid coming up, I got this private teacher. I was probably 14, maybe at the time, maybe even 13. I was 14. And he goes, have you ever heard Ornette Coleman? I said, nope. And he goes, you sound like him. I was like, okay. And so he ended up giving me an Ornette. And back then it was an LP. He gave me a vinyl, a record, and then a couple of tapes and cassette tapes. And I was like, oh, I don't know if I sound like this guy because he's really good, but, you know, I can get with it, right?
Yeah.
My teacher of 13, 14, whatever I was, already thought I sounded like Ornette before I even ever heard Ornette.
That's crazy.
And right. But I don't know what comes first, the chicken or the egg, right? I do not know. Like, did you grow up, Adam, you know, knowing that you wanted to be a programmer, you know, a software engineer, or did you learn how to become a software engineer? I don't know. It's an interesting question.
Yeah.
I mean, do you want to answer that or is that annoying?
No, it's fine. I that was a thing that I got onto when I was pretty young. And I was so young that I no longer remember why I took to it so quickly, but I remember, friends of our family had an early Apple computer. It was like a Lisa.
Oh, Lisa. And it did have BASIC or the,
It would have had BASIC
Cobalt or something like this.
Would have been, I think it was BASIC because that was the first language I learned.
I remember Lisa, and I think that's where I learned how to program BASIC. And I think Cobalt came after that, right?
No, Cobalt I think is older. Okay. Cobalt is pretty old. And I never used it.
It was a stupid fucking coding language. Cobalt was so stupid.
Well, it was like really those pioneering when it came out.
Fair enough. But it was like those cards. What were those cards called?
Punch cards?
Yeah, the punch cards.
Yeah.
So I learned the punch cards.
Oh, you actually got to see the punch cards.
Yeah, totally. And Cobalt and then BASIC. I guess I don't remember the sequence, but it was something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But those punch cards, like, what?
Man? Yeah, you know.
That's some cool shit. Like, who thought that shit up? Somebody's like, you know what we should do? We get pieces of paper, man, and punch holes in it, and the computer reads it, and then it does something, right? Like, who thinks of this shit?
That's maniacal. At some point, if once we're on the other side of COVID and can travel freely again, I should just look it up on YouTube. I've never seen a punch card computer in operation.
I swear to God to you, heart's honor. I was in college. I was in computer science minor, and our teacher handed out punch cards, okay, to each of us. They were all different. And our test was we had to figure out what the code was in the punch card without feeding it in. Yeah, correct.
Unbelievable.
It's such a vivid memory because you know, the smell of old paper.
Mm-hmm.
Like that, what is that, musty kind of smell? I just remember the smell.
Yeah.
And they're like, okay, write down what your card does.
Right.
Like,
here's a program.
Right.
What is a punch card?
Right. No, it's just one. Like, what's its function? One.
Okay. Yeah.
What's its function?
Yeah.
Such a weird technology. But for me, I'm kind of a dork or a nerd. I'm like, who the fuck sat around and thought about that?
It's I guess in a way it's similar to a player piano.
Oh yeah, you're right. Right? It is.
I guess that's already a pretty wild invention. So I guess that's probably the predecessor, the precursor to punch card computers. It's the same principle, reading holes in a piece of paper.
Right. I mean, I could literally smoke a joint and talk to you about this kind of stuff all night because I'm like, All right. When it comes to the program, the basic, like mm-hmm. that I got. If yes, yeah. then go here. Well, it's if words, no, and yeah. then go here. Yeah. If maybe, then next question. Like that I can understand.
Totally.
But COBOL was just a shit show, in my opinion. As you said, a transition to the next generation yeah. of software.
What? Yeah. Yeah, COBOL is funny because, two things. One, it was developed, I believe, in 1959.
Okay.
By a woman named Grace Hopper.
Oh yeah, Grace. She was that. That's like been kind of going around, right?
Yeah. Well, she, you know, because she was a really sort of spicy.
And no offense to her, like she totally forged, right? Like, you know, the way.
Yeah. I mean,
but
yeah.
I could not get my head around that particular program. Sorry.
Yeah, I've never sort of spent time with it, so I don't know exactly what it's like. But there is so much COBOL code kicking around that apparently they're having difficulty replacing COBOL programmers who retire.
Wow.
So they still need them, and then these people retire, and they're having a difficult time finding people who are willing to learn COBOL and do those jobs, which I think it's kind of funny that 60 years after it was invented, there's still all that code hanging around.
I say this a lot in the show, but that is so fascinating to me because there is an infrastructure on the internet, right? And also when people use what Photoshop or Final Cut Pro or QuickTime or iMovie or
right.
you know, whatever people are using,
yeah,
there's this functionality that none of us, I mean, not you, but me and a lot of people were totally unaware of, or like we're on our phone and we're using Siri, but who really is Siri, right? Who yeah. wrote that code?
Right.
And is there COBOL embedded in that code? So when these people retire or, you know, pass on, you know, will we have to just, you know, erase the slate and start all over again? I don't know.
I mean, the amount of code that people now interact with that is just completely opaque, you know, it's a staggering amount of stuff of code back there that the world now seems to kind of run on.
I got the first iPhone. Okay. Like think I'm in the hospital, brain cancer. My sister said, we're buying you one of these new iPhones. So
yeah,
2008, 2009, okay. something like this.
Yeah.
And anyway, I was like, wow, this fucking thing is cool, right? Like, I mean, wow. And I was like, but you can't copy and paste. So I called Apple. That's back when you can actually talk to somebody at Apple. And I said, how come I can't copy and paste? She goes, we don't know how to do that yet. You know what I'm not making this up. You know what I'm talking about, right?
I know because I know you can do it now.
Right. But she, the girl, she was a girl and she was probably 20 something. But she's like, yeah, we don't know how to do that yet.
Yeah.
And now it's just taken for granted.
Yeah.
You hold your finger down. Everybody knows.
Right.
Copy, forward, you know, text or whatever you're forwarding. Right. But 2008, she's like, yeah, we don't know how to do that on the phone yet.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, because it's that whole Apple developed all of that touchscreen functionality. You know, I mean, I'm not going to say they did it all by themselves. I'm sure that there were other people working on that technology as well. But like developing it into what it is now was, yeah, it's a process. And it was a lot of new work, I think, to some extent, you know. But it's amazing to think it wasn't that long ago.
It's impressive. It's impressive. And it was 10 years ago. Well, 12 yeah. years ago, for those of you who are anal. But it's like, it wasn't, right? So your kid, like my friend's grandkids who are 4 and 8 or whatever they are, 5 and 8. You know, they just like use their phone, you know, copy and paste, you know, send a photo like, hey, a selfie, you know, no problem.
Yeah.
But just 10 years ago, it was like, yeah, we don't really know how to do the copy and paste thing yet. Get back to us.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
I fucking love that. And I love that there's a guy who invented copy and paste. What's his name? Yeah. Do you remember?
I don't remember.
He passed away like last year or something.
I think you're right about that. Yeah.
I sent you and Nicole the article.
Yeah.
I love that there's somebody who invented copy and paste. Like,
that's
what?
One of those things that's like becomes so fundamental.
Right. Like, yeah. So somebody had to invent that. Mm-hmm. Somebody invented Siri. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in the meantime, people are focused on, man, Facebook's following me, man. Have you seen this social experiment, man? Like, yeah, you know what? You don't fucking know even 1% of what you're doing on your phone and what's behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oblique or opaque? What was the term you used?
Opaque. Yeah.
Opaque.
Yeah.
You don't have any idea when you open up your phone app or, I mean, sorry, your mail app or, you know, whatever it is. It's like you have no idea of the speculation and the development that goes on behind the scenes, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, and, you know, now people are loving the their home cameras and the computer systems that, you know, control the temperature in the apartment and the locks on the doors and all right. of these things. And, you know, I mean, this is a lot of stuff that, like, it feels like a thermostat from the old days or whatever. But it's not a thermostat from the old days.
Right. You're like on your phone going, okay, I want it to be 78 in here or whatever like that.
Right. And that's like that's a data stream, right? Of you making a decision about your house temperature, and that's going through the internet to some server somewhere and then probably being stored and then going back to your house and then changes
Jesus
the temperature
Christ,
in your house.
Really? Like, so you're not even directly communicating with the thermostat. You think it goes somewhere and then comes back to the thermostat? Is that what you're saying?
Oh yeah.
Wow.
So, I mean, if you're not, you know, I'm thinking like if these applications are internet, they call it the Internet of Things. So the control is an application that lives in the cloud somewhere. So it's not going through your local network, through your router in your house. It's, if you're in your house, it goes to the router in your house, but then it goes out to the internet.
And then comes back.
And then it comes back.
Jesus Christ.
And if you're not in your house, because people do this, right? They're not in their house. And like, you know, they're like, oh, maybe somebody's coming to visit and they can let them in maybe when they come off the plane and they show up. They can let them in remotely. And then they maybe before they arrive, I'm just talking hypothetical here. Like they want to change the temperature in the house because usually the house is empty, but this person is visiting and they're going to get to your house before you get home from work or whatever. I'm talking pre-COVID times, right?
Right, of course.
And so you're at work and like you're changing the temperature in your house from your phone at your job, right? That goes up to the internet.
Right. That's all. The big joke I've been telling is the big joke. Are you supposed to announce that shit? Well, anyway, I can always take it out. Is my 96-year-old neighbor is trying to get vaccinated from COVID. And hopefully by the time this episode comes out, that'll be solved. But she called me and she said, Andrew, you got to call the internet to get an appointment for me for the vaccine. I was like, call the internet. In my head, I do not give her a hard time because she doesn't right. know what... And I said, do you have a number? She goes, yeah, it's a something.com. You got to call them. I was like, okay.
I'll get right on it.
So what is that .com? She goes, 877, you know, 765, whatever. And she goes, and what area code is that? Like, oh, this is the shitstorm that these elderly people are like, that you're talking about. You know, we don't know the back end of our phones, but right. these people don't even know the front end of right. this stuff.
Yeah.
So I got to call the internet to get her a vaccine at a .com that starts with 877. So I'm like,
that's and magnificent.
I'm not making fun. It's glorious. But at the same time, I can't imagine when you and I are 90, if we make it to the 90 or whatever we are, and like what it's going to be for us, you know, what does that think? I mean,
I've kind of been obsessed with this for a long time, like how the pace of technological change is increasing. Like
right.
it's not, we're not just getting more advanced technologically, but we're doing it more quickly. And, you know, I used to think, well, I still do think that so much change happens now within a human lifetime, and that it's vastly different than in the past, right? Like our grandparents, things changed, but over the course of their lifetime, not that much. They changed a little bit, but so, not that much.
So like in the case of my mom, who is dealing with dementia, but anyway, she remembers when they got a phone, she was eight. She remembers when they got a phone, she was eight. And she remembers when they got the TV, because they were the only people in her, you know, small town that had a TV.
Right.
And I said, Mom, do you somehow with dementia, you can remember 8,000 years ago, but you can't remember what you had for breakfast, whatever. And I said, Mom, do you remember the first thing you watched on the TV? And she goes, I think it was Eisenhower, his acceptance speech.
Okay.
And I said, Truman, maybe it was Truman.
Okay. Yeah.
So this would be 1949. Yeah. Something like this. And I said, do you realize I have something in my fucking pocket where I can watch that?
Did she understand this?
No. She goes, what are you talking about? I'm just saying, Mom, I have a device, my phone, where I could literally pull up that acceptance speech, which, by the way, is forever changed after what's been happening, right? It's forever changed, everybody.
Yeah.
Like, imagine you're 8 years old and your friends are sitting in front of your black and white TV with the antenna on the roof of the house, right? And you're watching this acceptance speech of the president and you're like, oh my God, I can't believe it's a tiny screen. And I'm like, Mom, I can literally watch this while I'm talking to you on the phone.
Yeah.
I can bring it up.
Yeah.
And she was like, I don't know what you're talking about. But my point is, like you said, my mom remembers her phone. She remembers getting the TV and then nothing for about 80 years. Nothing else.
Right. There's like these like exciting things. And then it's chill for a while. But now it's like things change so quickly that I think for us, it's going to be really disorienting.
You think so? Really?
I do. Yeah.
And by us, you mean you and me, or what do you mean by us?
You and me and our generation are going to experience like technological change that's going to kind of blow our minds and is going to be very difficult to deal with.
Hey, man, I still can't write a meaningful email on my phone. I just cannot do it. I have to go on my computer. And I have to type old school.
Sure. Yeah.
And we're going to finish up here. Adam, thank you so much. Thank you, man, for being here. Thank you for your time and your positivity and your love. Jeez. All right. And everything that you've done for all of us. Thank you very much. And I just would like to open up if there's anything you want to share with everybody, you know, final thoughts, anything that you want to.
Yeah. I mean, thanks for having me on. I'm
my pleasure, man.
Excited to be part of the show. I'm looking forward to having it come out. And, you know, I think, we're all having kind of a tricky time, you know, with the virus and everything. And, perhaps the virus will be behind us when this gets on the air. You know, I just want to exhort people to take care of themselves, because it's hard for everybody. So
beautiful. Thank you. And just to follow up on that, I promise I won't talk too long. I saw this politician, I don't remember which station, and the person interviewing says, is the coronavirus going away? And she answered, no, but it's here to stay. And you know, with the different mutations and shit, it's like, I mean, I'll be curious. I mean, 9/11 hasn't gone away. It's been 20 years. It's still here. Yeah. So I'll be curious. And sorry, that sounded negative, but maybe it's just the reality that we'll have to, you know, on some level, always be managing this virus. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's sort of something that we're all kind of trying to not think about too much.
It's like in the back of our minds, right?
Yeah.
Excuse me. that totally. Old saying, like, we're all kind of thinking, is this going to really go like tomorrow, you know, or like, 2021, man, everything's going to be cool. And like, all right, we got a new president, man. It's going to be cool. And it's like, anyway, thank you, Adam. And have a beautiful evening. And I'll talk to you later and give your wife a hug from me, okay? And a kiss on the cheek.
I will. Thanks a lot, Andrew.
All right, man. Talk to you later.
Take care. Bye. Okay.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Constant Constance. Tune in every week for new conversations. And if you want even more, check out Andrew's Patreon for more exclusive content and additional conversations. Hosted and produced by Andrew D'Angelo. Edited and mixed by Lucy Little. Original music by Andrew D'Angelo and Maximilian Moore D'Angelo. Intro is Henrietta Weeks. Thanks so much. See you next time.
You fucking beautiful. Yeah, you fucking rocked it. Like, she doesn't know she says podcast, right? Like, she doesn't even